AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, collaboration, and creativity. No product can be absolutely secure. Learn more at intel.com/itheroes.
The IRS plans to audit large hedge fund and real estate firms this month. And how a small bank in Philadelphia faces a test of depositors' faith.
The fundamental question here is, do we really need to be rethinking what it means to be systemic or to be too big to fail?
Plus, how Apple's become a pawn in a fight between the U.S. and China. It's Friday, September 8th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. The IRS is preparing dozens of audits this month of large hedge funds and real estate firms. The companies it's auditing aren't being named publicly, but the IRS commissioner says the agency used artificial intelligence to select them. Last year, Congress allocated billions of dollars to the IRS to increase enforcement and improve technology and taxpayer service. Our U.S. tax policy reporter Richard Rubin joins me now with more. Richard, to start, why the focus on these hedge funds and real estate partnerships? What are the concerns there?
Yeah, so from the IRS's perspective, they're really trying to fill a longstanding gap in their enforcement ability. A lot of these partnerships, and again, we don't know exactly which ones they are complex, they're multi-tiered, they'll have thousands of partners and entities upon entities that control bits of each other. And so they're very difficult for the IRS to unwind and untangle, and they require a lot of time and specialized skill from the government side to figure out what's actually going on inside of these partnerships and whether they're complying with the tax law. The IRS, when it got the $80 billion in the Inflation Reduction Act last year, and along with the Treasury Department, decided really to put money first into taxpayer service, the stuff that's really visible. It's a very simple function of, you know, put more money in and you get results. The enforcement, like we talked about, is just a little bit longer. And because the IRS can't talk about which taxpayers are being audited and what the results are until and unless cases are in court, it's just much less visible.
Will the IRS be able to see these changes through?
At least some of them, yes. I mean, there is a long tail to tax enforcement, particularly when it comes to high-income tax enforcement. So the IRS is in the process of hiring people who will work on these cases, as well as, you know, starting them with the staff they have. Then have to gather all the information from the companies. They'll go back and forth with the companies. They'll issue a notice of deficiency. The companies might appeal. They can go through court. So it can take quite a while for one of these cases to come to fruition.
What about some of the broader challenges the IRS is facing in terms of using the money that Congress allocated?
You know, what Congress giveth, Congress can taketh, right? And so Republicans, I think, are very skeptical of the enforcement side of things. They're generally supportive of taxpayer service funding, and some are supportive of technology funding, though there's concern about how that money is used. But there's real open questions as we have this divided government now and as we head into whatever the 2024 election cycle looks like, about whether the IRS will continue to have the funding support that it looked like it was getting when Democrats were in charge.
That's Wall Street Journal U.S. tax policy reporter Richard Rubin. Apple has become a pawn in the economic Cold War between the U.S. and China. This week, we reported that China is banning government workers from using iPhones and other foreign-branded devices for work or at work. Apple's stock price fell nearly 7% over the past 2 days. That's about $194 billion in market value. While that might be a drop in the bucket for Apple, China's pressure campaign could have big implications for the company and the broader tech industry. Here now to talk about it is our Heard on the Street columnist Dan Gallagher. Dan, China's move was in retaliation to severe restrictions the U.S. had placed on shipments of advanced chips and other technology to China. How much damage can China's actions do?
Well, I mean, to Apple, theoretically, they could do a lot, because Apple gets now about 19% of its annual revenue from China. It's a very profitable market for Apple, and Apple's regarded as a status symbol there, or at least it has been in years past. But when you have an action like this, that you've got something that was a status symbol and now the government's essentially putting like kind of a seal of disapproval on it, it's hard to know what effect that's going to have.
If China is able to hurt Apple's business, What does that mean for other tech companies? I mean, we're talking about a tech giant here.
Well, it's potentially bad. That's why you saw a lot of tech stocks actually go down yesterday, because Apple's kind of had this immunity a bit in a way, because one, they are such a major employment force in China. And Tim Cook and other Apple executives have worked very hard to keep political connections positive in China. And so the fact that like China is now determining that it can go after essentially what's the crown jewel of U.S. tech and a major local employment force means that there's not really any tech company that's like theoretically safe. Any American company doing business in China theoretically is under some threat.
I've been speaking with Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street columnist Dan Gallagher. Coming up, a small bank in Philadelphia is facing a test of depositors' faith. What it could mean for the broader banking industry after the break.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/IT heroes.
A small Philadelphia lender with $6 billion in assets is providing a key test of depositors' faith in small banks, especially after the banking crisis earlier this year. The lender is Republic First, and it happens to share some similarities with its near namesake, First Republic. That's the unrelated San Francisco bank that collapsed in March. Here now to talk about why Republic First is a test of faith is Wall Street Journal finance reporter Jonathan Weil. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jonathan, what's interesting is that these two banks with very similar names did a lot of the same things and even shared a few of the same problems. Why, then, is Republic First still standing?
Republic First is still standing in part because its depositors largely have remained loyal. The deposits over the past year are down just 10%, which is not unusual for the industry at this point. And it's been able to meet its obligations.
This is a really small bank in the grand scheme of things. Why is it a focus?
To put it in perspective, this bank isn't necessarily the smallest bank. By assets, it's much bigger than the vast majority of banks. But compared with a bank that we would normally think of as systemically important, it is tiny. It is 0.2% the size of J.P. Morgan Chase by total assets. It has some very well-documented financial difficulties. If you look at its balance sheet, total equity, which is assets minus liabilities, was $183 million as of June 30th, but that didn't include $304 million of unrealized losses on their bonds, which when you value them on a fair market value basis, the losses on those bonds exceed the equity of the company. So there are assets on there that are not worth on a fair market value basis what they're allowed to say the assets are worth under the accounting rules. In addition, it has a very high concentration compared with other banks of uninsured deposits. And when you put those two together, the problems with its asset values, the high concentration of uninsured deposits, its inability to raise capital in order to fill that capital hole. It's tried and failed already this year, although it has kept trying. And its delinquency on filing audited financial statements, which led to its stock being delisted. It is a test case, potentially, if it's unable to raise capital, it's a test case in the end for what might happen with uninsured deposits and whether or not they would be backstopped, just like they were backstopped at larger lenders that failed earlier this year because of the perceived systemic risk that they posed. So the fundamental question here is, do we really need to be rethinking what it means to be systemic or to be too big to fail? And it is totally possible, for all we know, that someone will inject fresh capital into Republic First Bank, and maybe they'll get out of this. You could also have a situation where if interest rates were to fall again, that would be helpful for their bond portfolio. But But the scenario really comes down to who is too big to fail? Do we have to be rethinking what that term means or if it's even applicable to policy discussions anymore? And is a more important question, or an equally important question, what does it mean to be systemically risky?
So what is next, Jonathan? What are you going to be keeping an eye on?
In the case of Republic First, I'll be keeping an eye on how this bank does. From a big picture standpoint, one of the boxes that the FDIC and banking regulators are in right now is there's no easy way to change the deposit insurance rules without an act of Congress. Acts of Congress are pretty hard to get through right now on such a grand scale that this would require. Every situation's different. What is novel here is the idea that very small banks could also be presenting systemic risk. And I'll be looking to see if policymakers make any headway on exploring different options for changing the way deposit insurance works.
Jonathan, what have we heard from Republic First?
After our story was published, Republic First put out a statement on its website. They said that they have enough liquidity to cover all uninsured deposits and that their customers, through their products and services, have the ability to ensure that all of their deposits are FDIC insured. And as we noted also in the story, for regulatory capital purposes, Republic First is deemed well capitalized.
I've been speaking with Wall Street Journal finance reporter Jonathan Weil. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Global food prices fell in August thanks to a strong supply of wheat, corn, and other goods. That's according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which found global prices for a basket of staple foods was down 2.1% in August from the previous month. But commodities reporter Yusuf Khan says there are still some risks. The price of rice, for example, has shot up as a result of Indian export restrictions.
Rice prices have shot up to a 15-year high because India's put in sort of a whole host of export restrictions around the grain. And really, you know, for a lot of the world that depends on rice, that's going to be a really important and quite tough to bear. The other grains, like so wheat and corn, they've come down quite a lot. We're seeing quite healthy crops and quite healthy exports from places like Russia and Brazil for wheat and corn, respectively. And meat prices are falling, dairy prices are falling. It's really kind of rice and sugar at the moment that are kind of the main factors of sort of where prices are sort of going higher.
Hurricane Lee has been downgraded to a Category 4 storm, but it is expected to remain a powerful hurricane over the Atlantic Ocean well into next week. Forecasters are urging people in the Caribbean and on the U.S. East Coast to keep an eye on its path. The National Hurricane Center says most of the East Coast will see life-threatening rip currents starting this weekend. Lee's path is still uncertain, but forecasters say they should know in the coming days if it ends up tracking toward land. Lee is the fourth hurricane to form in the Atlantic this year. It's been a more active season because of unusually warm waters. And finally, you might assume a personal health reporter lives, well, a healthy lifestyle. In fact, it's something Alex Janin, who covers health and wellness for the Wall Street Journal, gets asked about a lot. So she turned it into a challenge. Could she live a perfect day? She wanted to find out if she could use all the tips she learned from experts, like eating a diet according to federal nutrition guidelines, getting in 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise, and ensuring 7 to 9 hours of sleep each night. But Alex found that living a perfect day isn't so easy.
I had about half a cup of blueberries in my yogurt. I had one apple. I'm not sure how many cups of fruit an apple is. Saturated fat, I have no idea. How are we calculating this, guys? I'm not keeping up with this. I would have had to look at a lot of labels. A lot of the stuff that I made didn't have a label. So I'm going to say question mark on that and question mark on sodium, same issue.
She says one of the lessons she learned is that it's okay if you stumble.
I realized by the end of the day, when it came down to certain health decisions, like, should I read in bed? Should I put my phone away? When faced with that choice, by the end of the day, so much had already gone wrong that it was easier for me to justify that decision because I was thinking I already sort of messed up. So I think that acknowledging that you can get yourself back on track, and that's really hard, especially by the end of the day when we're exhausted and we've been working so hard and maybe all we want to do is crash into bed with our phone. It's best to resist that urge if we can, and if we can't, don't beat yourself up.
For more on Alex's attempt to live a perfect day, check out her story on WSJ.com. And that's What's News for this week. Today's show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Anthony Bansi. What's News is hosted by me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. Additional support this week from David Luno and J.R. Whalen. Our supervising producers are Sandra Kilhoff and Michael Kosmides. Aisha Al-Muslim is our development producer. Scott Salloway and Chris Sinsley are our deputy editors. And Falana Patterson is the Wall Street Journal's head of news audio. We'll be back with a new show on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.